This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
These are just anecdotes, but it's building up into something more coherent.
You know, I think it'd be interesting to really try to unravel what his
and
ties.
There's a sort of country-city divide.
They're inconvenient ends, and it's not clear where it goes next.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I read the spy novel Red Sparrow by the former CIA agent Jason Matthews not long after it was published in 2013. Now, a film based on Red Sparrow, directed by Francis Lawrence, has just come out, and the timing couldn't be better. Russian intelligence directed against the U.S. is on the front page just about every day, along with the national conversation about sexual coercion at work. And somehow, Red Sparrow brings those themes together. It's about a former ballerina pressured into joining a special branch of Russian intelligence whose spies work by seducing men to get information. And while the story is fiction, programs like this did exist in Soviet spy agencies and in our own.
Every human being is a puzzle of need. You must learn to intuit what is missing, become the missing piece, and they will give you anything.
Take off your clothes. You must learn to sacrifice for a higher purpose. To push yourself beyond all limitation and forget the sentimental morality with which you were raised.
The lead character, the ballerina turned spy, is named Dominika Yegorova, and she's played by the unbeatable Jennifer Lawrence. Lawrence has been a fierce presence in movies like The Hunger Games. She was hilarious in American Hustle and heartbreaking in Winter's Bone and Silver Linings Playbook. Jennifer Lawrence joined me in the studio here last week.
I have a confession to make. I read all these novels, beginning with Red Sparrow, and the new one has just come out. Now, do you read the novel that the movie is based on, or do you not want to know what's in it? How does it work?
I started it, and then I was, I think Frances got a little freaked out that it would scare me because the books are a little more sexualized than the movie is. And you have to change so much to turn a novel into a movie that it's two different characters. So it would have been confusing. And I'm also always looking for any excuse to stop reading. So I was like...
You were bored?
No, I was just working. I was on Passengers.
So in this movie, you play the ultimate spy. She's so good that she fools the entire Russian intelligence establishment. And at the same time, she's terrified the entire movie. Mm-hmm. And it's a highly sexualized movie. I mean, even made the book maybe more or less. How do you prepare for this? That role seemed like it would be something to be anxious about in a number of different ways.
Yeah, I was very anxious about this. It was a lot to wrap my head around. You know, I had like one full year to prepare myself for the certain super intense sexual scenes, so like a year of preemptive anxiety. The night before, I didn't sleep at all, but I just kept going back to, I love this movie. Like, I read it. It was a really exciting challenge. I also loved the take and the perspective that they chose to tell in the life of espionage. You know, it's not like a Jane Bond. It's really the brutality of such a lifestyle of living a double life.
Your character is pushed into being a spy by an uncle, and he pushes you to go to this school. It's called Sparrow School, where young women and young men too are taught to be Mata Hari type figures, to use their sexuality to entrap other people. What did they say about that?
It is a real program. No one knows if it still exists to this day. The United States actually tried to use sparrows on Russia in the 50s and 60s, but it didn't work because of our difference in cultural cultural differences.
Why would that be?
They would blackmail and say, we're going to show these pictures to your wife, and they'd be like, do it. And then the Americans were like,
So I'm curious, did you want me to know that you were following me, or are you just real clumsy?
The Americans always think the rest of us are so interested in you, don't you?
So what made you want to become a translator?
My mother is unwell. If I work for the government, the state helps me take care of her. My uncle helped me get the job.
Your uncle is a very powerful man.
In my country, if you don't matter to the men in power, you do not matter.
Hey, I'd like to see you again.
Why are we going to become friends?
How did you learn a Russian accent?
First was finding which dialect, because, you know, every city has its own. And then my dialect coach, Tim Monick, found women who had been living either in America or in England that speak good English. It was just really strict homework. And I couldn't use any dialogue from the script because I feel like it dies. Like after like three times, I can feel it just die.
I mean, if you do lines from the script more than a few times, it flattens out.
For me, it does. I mean, I can remember what it looks like and imitate it, but there's a certain feeling that you get when you're first saying it or you're first reading it that
I try to hold on to.
I don't know what it is. I mean, when I was doing Mother, I was listening to headphones, you know, listening to Bruce Springsteen's Santa Claus Is Coming to Town while we were blocking out the horrific scene where my baby dies, because I just couldn't have those feelings come too early. So I was like, Santa Claus is coming to town. And then the baby dies over there. Santa Claus is coming to town.
What do you say no to when roles are coming at you the way they must come at you all the time from your agent or manager? What kind of roles come at you typically, and you say, no, I don't want any part of that?
Well, before this, nudity to overtly sexual. Now, I mean, I try to stay away from being redundant, you know, doing something I know I can do. I don't know. It's scarier now because I'm not in between Hunger Games. It's too much pressure. I read something and then all of a sudden it's getting made, and I'm like, is everybody just making this because I said yes? Because I don't know. What does everybody else think? Is this good? You know.
Well, why did you change your mind for Red Sparrow? In other words, if you were rejecting things that had nudity involved, why did you change your mind for this?
I mean, my real desire to do the movie, to push myself this way and to become this character and to do a foreign, you know, all of these things that seemed really scary and challenging me. To me, I didn't want my fears and insecurities and fear of being judged to get in the way of me doing something that I really, really wanted to do and be a part of.
When you say judged, how do you feel the judging coming at you? Are you guilty of going on Twitter or social media, and can't you stay away from it?
Yeah, I can't do it during a press tour because it's too intense. It's so heightened, like, during this time, and I always have to remind myself that it does go away. It really crescendos when a movie's coming out, and I always have this moment where I'm like, I can't do this. It's not worth it. I'm not happy. I started doing this because it made me happy, and I'm not happy anymore. And then the movie comes out. Everyone forgets about me. Another actress has a movie coming out. Everyone hates her. Thank God Amy Schumer has a movie coming out. Amy, good luck.
you think
they'll all start hating
she'll
Amy.
Be all over her.
Thank God she'll take it, take the brunt.
And you think guys get this too?
I don't think it's as much. I think that's kind of obvious. I don't know why. I can't break it down for you. I can't break down the psyche. I don't know why Greta Gerwig would be the only one backstage asked about Woody Allen when other men have worked with him and they don't get asked after they've won. I don't know why the intense scrutiny on women. I don't know why we're so easy to be unlikable.
When you see men support Woody Allen, Alec Baldwin and others, how do you feel?
I don't know. I you know, it's hard for me to say anything, and I'm right at the place right now where I just get scrutinized for everything. But I don't know what the right answer is, to be honest.
The Oscars are going to be in a few days, and there's a kind of weight on this Oscars. In the past, there have been uncertain issues, whether it was Vietnam long ago or Marlon Brando turning it down, but that was kind of a surprise. What do you want to see happen?
At the Oscars? Yeah. Or overall?
Yeah,
at
no,
Oscars,
at the Oscars.
I don't, I mean, I feel like we've really talked about it. I feel like people are supportive. I mean, it certainly needs to be acknowledged.
No, you live there, I don't. You're in that environment, I'm not. What's changed and what has not changed at all?
There's still not a lot of transparency with pay. There needs to be just across-the-board transparency. I wouldn't say yes to any number without looking to see what the other people in the movie were getting paid. I think that there's a little bit of a battle going on right now, and some people are getting frustrated. I can see even some women are getting frustrated. But Time's Up is an amazing commission. We are making actual strategic changes. Changing guidelines on set, creating a hotline where you can call, legal defense fund if you feel like you can't take your abuse to court. Those people are really doing things, and they are not shouting every day from a rooftop and making explosive tweets and
You sound frustrated with that.
I am frustrated by it because it really makes the movement unlikable. And easy to just go, oh, God, it's so annoying.
I think you're talking about things like a social media flap about a dress you once wore that some people found too sexy.
And they're actually creating a distraction from a very real issue that really needs to be addressed and for the bigger cause.
Issue that's far beyond Hollywood. How do you experience that in I guess, what we'd call real life beyond Hollywood?
I don't know. I mean, I definitely hear... You know, people from my hometown talking about it more. It's a conversation now, and it's also a safer conversation. Nobody can really deny that these things are going on anymore. Nobody can really deny that women aren't being paid equally. Nobody can deny that when more men are in positions of power, there is more sexual abuse. There just is. We need more diversity. We need more women and more people of color and in positions of power. Then less abuse will happen.
You're going to take a year off. What, I mean, your career is blazing hot, and then you're going to take a pause for a year. Why and what are you going to do?
I haven't found that thing that I want to be on set for yet, but I'm going to use this year where I'm not going to be actually on set to travel around America. I'm a part of an organization called Represent Us, and the basic idea is passing state-by-state legislation to prevent corruption and big money in politics. But my part of the piece for the next year is just going to be talking to young people, getting them engaged politically.
And you've seen how people in Hollywood or people from various worlds of so-called celebrity, it cuts both ways when they get involved in politics.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a terrible idea. I mean, I noticed that right away as soon as I just started. I mean, it was bad.
You felt a react.
Yeah. Well, and I think I had like a 70% Republican fan base or something. But the funny thing is I'm not even talking about what people's politics should
be. Wait, how do you know you have a 70%?
I don't know. My publicist just said that to me one day. I mean, it's not a good idea because my job relies on everyone going to see my movies. But my political views are my own, and I respect
somebody
else.
No, I mean something else. I mean, sometimes people react to celebrities. You'll forgive me for using that word. But getting into politics, like, who were they to tell me who to vote?
Oh,
they
of
get,
course.
They get
yeah,
pissed off
that
about
too.
That.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I certainly wouldn't go into something without doing my due diligence, educating myself enough. And I think that would be a problem, wouldn't it, if we started saying, oh, you can't help. I mean, that's the opposite of what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to go tell young people, you can do stuff. Find out your representative. Find what they stand for. And when the time comes, vote. But if there is something I can do to help, then I want to do that.
I want to ask you about fame. People talk about you and they say she's incredibly relatable, particularly for young women. It must make you feel good in some way, but what does it mean? And did you have somebody like that in your life growing up on the screen?
I don't know. I mean, I Love Lucy. I'd seen all of those. I don't know if I had like a particular, other than obviously Beyonce, like a celebrity that I felt like I had something in common with. When everybody always tells me that, I'm always just, I don't know why I would change. I get to do what I love. I'm very grateful. I know that there are aspects of my life that are weird, but they're just logistical.
What's the weird part?
The weird part is, like, sometimes I show up with a bodyguard, and that's weird, and I try not to do that. But they really are just logistical issues.
Well, it's like, not once just you logistical. Get to know you me, get your you realize... phone, you get your phone hacked, and pictures of you go all over the world.
Yeah, that's, and there's not, that too.
That's not the experience of most people. Is that something you would, at least in the moment, you say, you know, I'd give it all up not to have this kind of nonsense?
When I had my meltdown in London, my publicist loves when I just say I had a meltdown. I did. I cried. And I go back to, like, that's when I should have quit. And then when that didn't happen, I should have quit then. And then when that didn't happen, I should have quit then. And then it goes away and it calms down a little bit and I get to go back to my normal life.
What's your normal life? We were talking before about when you came in here, and one of your secret passions is Real Housewives. I want to know everything about that.
Oh, my God, you do?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, I love reality TV. It's a good way for my brain to shut off. But I've been watching, the funny thing is, like, my best girlfriends, we've all been watching them for over 10 years. So we're so invested in them that we can have genuine conversations where we don't crack a smile and we talk passionately for like 3 hours.
You're dead serious about Real Housewives?
I'm dead serious, just breaking down the life of Kylie Jenner, Kendall Jenner.
Okay, I haven't watched too many, but when I watched it in the beginning, I thought, A, two things. One, that Kim Kardashian is like the Andy Warhol of our time. She's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
And B, most of the show is about misplacing your cell phone. I don't know where my cell phone is. I lost my cell phone. There's a lot of talking about that.
Yeah.
And then the greatest episode I saw was when her now ex-husband threw her into the water.
That was so mean. And she lost the diamond. And then Courtney was like, people are dying, Kim. Yeah, I know what episode you're talking about.
I think it's possible that diamond was maybe
fake.
A freebie.
Oh, my gosh.
See, wow. Now the scales
fall
from
really,
your eyes.
It really, really makes me mad
yeah.
when men do this to me. No, it's all real. I reject that idea.
Do you ever think of yourself at 50, 60, what kind of presence that you'd want to be on screen?
No. Yeah. I go as far as hope that I am working at that age. Eventually, I'd like to direct, but... I want to make sure that I'm actually good at it, because Greta Gerwig really ruined that dream for me. She was like, I thought you wanted to direct. I was like, yeah, until Lady Bird. The film was perfect. I can't beat that.
But do you have a project in mind? The kind of movie do you like to make?
Yeah, it's about acid. I've never done acid, which is, I guess I should probably do before I direct a movie about acid, but... It's about John Ketchum, who was a scientist that he was using acid, trying to find tactics of warfare with no deaths and no injuries.
I would definitely see that movie.
You would?
Absolutely.
Oh, good. Okay, cool.
Jen Lawrence,
all right,
thank
I'll
you.
Make it. It's over? Oh, yeah. God.
Thank you.
I hope that was okay.
It was great. Thank you. Jennifer Lawrence. She stars in Red Sparrow, which is just out. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. After the horrific shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, survivors traveled to Tallahassee to ask lawmakers to demand of them that they take action on guns. They came away deeply frustrated because Florida has in place some of the most pro-gun laws in the nation, laws that would have seemed surprising, even unthinkable, a generation ago. Mike Spees has spent more than a year looking at guns and politics in Florida. He works for The Trace, which is a nonprofit news organization devoted to gun coverage, and his reporting led him to a 78-year-old NRA lobbyist called Marion Hammer. Mike Spees spoke with Evan Osnos, who's covered the NRA, too, as a staff writer at The New Yorker.
Mike, who is Marion Hammer?
So Marion Hammer is the NRA's Florida lobbyist, and for nearly four decades, she's been the most influential gun lobbyist in the country. She's turned Florida into this laboratory for experimental gun laws. Her two hallmarks, if you will, are first, her concealed carry law in the 80s. First of its kind, normalized the concealed carrying of handguns in public. Before that, it was extremely unusual. And then later on in the 2000s, she created one of the most notorious gun laws in the country, probably the most notorious, which was Stand Your Ground. If you felt like you were, if you were fearful in a particular situation, you no longer had the duty to retreat. You had the option of using force, which makes it much easier to kill a person.
You spent a year interviewing people about the role that Marion Hammer plays in Florida politics, and you used public records requests. What did you discover about how she works?
To me, the most interesting thing was lawmakers were essentially just acting as her fig leaves. They weren't doing the work of legislators. They were just abdicating their responsibilities to Marion. And that means that from the start to finish, she and when it comes to gun policy, she's overseeing the entire legislative process. But she is essentially a lawmaker that is unelected and doesn't, you know, have any of the public accountability or oversight.
Well, one of the things that comes through and that is really interesting, really gets to the heart of the puzzle around how the NRA wields the power that it does in American politics, is why. Why do lawmakers do what it is that Marion Hammer asks them to?
There are a couple tools that she has that she's willing to use that other special interests don't have. One is this massive army of people in Florida that can be anywhere between several hundred thousand people and even 2 million people who can be readily mobilized through these direct emails that she sends out giving updates on different pieces of legislation. That's a very potent group, especially during an election season. She can primary virtually any Republican in a red district, and they know that. That's coupled with this institutional authority that she's gained over four decades. She's so ingrained in the government that she is able to give orders to virtually everyone. That includes some of the top officials in the governor's office. I mean, she can punish you in a variety of ways. She can block your appointment to a particular judgeship. She can try to get you fired from a position you hold in a particular agency. There must be some satisfaction that she gets out of getting government officials to do what she tells them to do. I mean, when she does communicate with them, one thing you can see, especially in aggregate when you're looking at the thousands of emails, is that she does talk to these, not just the lawmakers, but the government employees, the employees in the governor's office. She talks to them as if they work for her. I mean, there are even these mundane emails, which are not mentioned in the story, where she's emailing Scott's, like, you know, chief executive assistant or whatever, and just saying, like, I want you to print this. I want you to send me this. And then they just immediately do it. It's not the thing that people have to realize is that that's not the way it works for most people. Most people, lobbyists included, don't just get to, like, email that to the governor's office and then get an immediate reply. And she's just always getting an immediate reply. She just always has the open ear and the, you know, the ability to give directions.
There's one particular example that you write about in detail in this piece. It has to do with a law that would allow people without permits to carry concealed handguns while they've been ordered to evacuate their homes, so during a hurricane or something like that. So tell me a little more about this particular bill. How did it come about?
It's just utterly bizarre. I mean, I just have to say that because that's what it is. And I, like most of the gun bills in Florida, there was no empirical need or evidence that suggested it was necessary. It's pretty easy to get a permit to get a concealed handgun in Florida. Very easy. That's why 1.8 million people there have them, way more than anyone else in the country.
You write about something that happened when the bill was being debated. This was in March of 2014, mm-hmm. and a lawyer from the Florida Department of Military Affairs named Captain Terrence Gorman spoke at a hearing for the bill. And he was speaking from the perspective of a first responder. And let's listen to a little bit of his testimony.
Sure. Yeah. I think you're exactly right. I think you said something that strikes the very heart of what we're asking the information on or what we're asking to deliberate. People aren't thinking clearly. Mm-hmm. And when people aren't thinking clearly, they probably shouldn't have a weapon shoved in the back of their pants. Especially when you're talking about thousands of people who need to be evacuated from an area. Mm-hmm. I 100% agree. People aren't thinking clearly. And we may need to balance the public safety aspect versus the personal safety aspect when it comes to carrying concealed, not from your front door to your car or your truck, but from the front door of your house to 150 miles away. Traffic jams, you know, bridge closures, things that where people do become frustrated. And there are actual, personal life safety issues at risk. Let's balance that personal safety issue with the public safety issue and the public safety issue of the fine police officers who respond and the National Guardsmen who are there on the ground.
So the point he's making seems, frankly, quite reasonable.
Yeah.
And how did Marion Hammer respond to Captain Gorman's testimony?
So she was outraged, despite the fact that he was a stakeholder in the bill who'd been sent there to participate. She immediately, after the hearing, went to the governor's office, demanded that the governor immediately take the opposite position that Gorman expressed during the hearing. And then she also wanted Captain Gorman to be severely punished. And by punished, I mean she wanted him to get fired.
What happened to him ultimately?
Ultimately, Gorman wasn't fired because the only person that could fire him, remove him from service, was General Emmett Titchaw, who recently retired. And when he was being bullied into doing that, he refused. He threatened to resign.
So Marion Hammer also spoke about that bill at a hearing. Let's hear some of her remarks.
In a state of an emergency with a hurricane coming and during an evacuation, if you leave your guns behind, there's a good chance they won't be there when you get back. Either destroyed in the hurricane or stolen by looters. And there's not going to be anybody there protecting your property once you leave. And when things are crazy and you've got your kids and your property in your car and you're trying to leave, you want to be sure that you can protect yourself because there's nobody else there to do that. We respect the military. We respect law enforcement. But we also know that the bad guys are going to do what they want to do, and the good guys need to be able to protect themselves.
You hear in her language, Mike, talk of good guys and bad guys. Is that something that's really central to her outlook?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the way she basically frames everything. And I think that's also the way the NRA largely frames everything with respect to the legislation that it cares about and the policies that it cares about. One of the most important things that the NRA does is to tell its members and gun owners that they are the good guys, the sheepdogs protecting society. It's, I guess, a good story, and it's a story that people want to hear and they're receptive to. So that's, she's just doing that again here.
As I was reading your piece, I was struck by the fact that Marion Hammer is 78 years old. She communicates with her members by email.
Right.
She is lobbying members of the legislature, some of whom have been around politics for decades in one way or another.
Right.
And then there is this other force at play, which we've seen come to the fore after the Douglas High School shooting, and that is these young people who are looking at politics and saying, this doesn't make sense to me. And on top of it, they don't even really use email that much.
Right, right, right. And I think that you're really right to point that out. I mean, I think that is where the hope lies. There's some portion of people that have just accepted that this is the way politics is. You know, this is and just, but it seems like these kids are just shocked by it. They're all of a sudden like, and they've been shocked by it in the most extreme way because of this horrible thing that's happened. And I think that's really the NRA's worst nightmare. I mean, they're very focused on appealing and recruiting young people to continue, you know, to continue the gravy train, so to speak. And the question of like whether or not maybe they just lost a generation, perhaps the most important one, you know, is definitely a question that's worth asking. I mean, these are people that are just, they're not okay with the way this works. And I think you think about people like Emma Gonzalez, who's been speaking so eloquently in public. I mean, I think someone like that is Marion Hammer's worst nightmare.
Mike, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Evan.
Staff writer Evan Osnow spoke with the reporter Mike Spies. You can find Spies' article about the lobbyist Marion Hammer and the NRA, which we published in partnership with The Trace, at NewYorker.com. And I'm David Remnick. Still ahead, the story of an extraordinary journey, an attempt to cross the Antarctic, alone and on skis. That's in a minute on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Good evening. So, on the way at last, about 100 miles from the Antarctic landmass.
In 2015, a British Army veteran named Henry Worsley set out to become the first person to cross Antarctica on foot, alone and unaided.
3.94 nautical miles over 3.5 hours travel was pleasing. I'm in great spirits. It's so wonderful to be back on the snow, heading south. Good night.
Worsley went on skis, pulling a sled loaded with more than 300 pounds of equipment, and he would pass the South Pole and then continue on to the other side of Antarctica.
Well, polar journeys are all about how fit and strong your mind and will are. Hours in the gym cannot prepare you for that moment. And the sound of the aeroplane that has just dropped you off at your star point fades. Or from then on, this beguiling continent will strip you bare.
It was about as difficult a journey as a human being could voluntarily undertake. Staff writer David Gran brings us the story of Henry Worsley.
I
Henry had been to the South Pole twice before, but this would be his first solo expedition. And it was also longer than his other expeditions and more dangerous than any other expedition he had ever attempted. Henry was a meticulous planner, ruthlessly whittling down all his equipment to the bare essentials. Most important was his satellite phone, which would allow him to stay in contact with ALE, Antarctic Logistics and Expeditions, a company that helped get polar explorers on and off the continent.
Okay, stats for today, decimal 660.
Each night after a long trek, he would call ALE, give them his medical condition and his coordinates. If he was ever in trouble, he could call for what he referred to as the most expensive taxi ride in the world, which would be a rescue plane to pull him out.
Distance. Thanks, Andy. Mike, you and Andrew.
He also called a friend in London so he could record an audio diary of his day, which could then be posted on his website. And it updated listeners about what he was going through, what he was eating, what he was feeling.
Good evening, everybody. Sun shone for most of the day, whilst wave after wave of low cloud cast intriguing bands of shadow and light that raced across the surface, creating strips of light, all running parallel to each other. It was cold.
He was incredibly good looking. And at that point, most of my friends were in the art world, in books or theatre or film, and we all thought that someone in the Special Forces was very, very glamorous. So,
Henry met his wife Joanne at a party in London in 1989. He had recently completed his selection course for the Special Air Service, or SAS, a legendary elite commando unit.
And actually... I like adventurous people. I think it's great talking to people who are adventurers.
So the SAS has extreme endurance tests, which you have to pass in order to qualify. Several people have died even trying to take that course. Henry was among the very few who passed it. And in many ways, he and Joanna were opposites. She hates the cold. She couldn't think of any more dreadful place in the world than Antarctica. Yet for all their differences, they shared a similar sensibility.
He really was a true romantic. He loved poetry. He loved art. He did tapestry. He stitched the most wonderful tapestry of two sledges going across the snow. He loved the history of all these old explorers, and he glamorized their lives in his head.
We retraced our steps over crevasses, through soft snow, in panting blizzards, till eventually on the 1st of March.
Henry worshipped Ernest Shackleton, who in many ways was a failure as an explorer. On his first expedition that he commanded himself, he set out to reach the South Pole with three other men. They got within 97 miles, nautical miles, of the pole, but he feared that if he kept going, his men who were already fading would not make it back.
Those 14 men who were my comrades, who, regardless of self...
And so he made a decision that always astonished Henry Worsley. He decided to turn back.
And it has been through them that we have achieved...
And on his other most famous expedition, Shackleton had wanted to walk across Antarctica. He thought it was the last great prize to be achieved. But before he even reached Antarctica, his ship, the Endurance, got frozen in the ice. And Shackleton found him and all his men marooned on an ice floe more than 800 miles from the closest island with any contact with civilization. What made it so amazing was he was able to guide all the men in his immediate party and get them back all home alive.
I can only say, speaking here now, that they have been loyal to the very core throughout the trying times we've gone through.
I was very interested as a child. Photographs of the Endurance story absolutely captivated me. I started reading more of the diaries and the accounts that they wrote about those expeditions.
Henry found out that one of his ancestors, Frank Worsley, had been the captain of the Endurance ship on the Endurance expedition.
So yes, this all started at a very early age.
He began to burn with this very peculiar ambition, which very few share, which was to kind of suffer these miseries and become a polar explorer. And the motto that he lived by was Shackleton's family motto, which was, by endurance we conquer.
I should have had warning bells when he came back from a trip to South Georgia just after I first met him and was incredibly excited because he had managed to sleep beside Shackleton's grave. And it wasn't until when he was about 40 that he started really talking about wanting to do an expedition and follow in Shackleton's footsteps.
So by the time Henry was talking about doing his first expedition, he had two children, Max and Alicia. Initially, when he decided he wanted to do something that, you know, how many people say suddenly, wait a second, I want to go walk to the South Pole. You know, his kids were a little bit bewildered, but Joanna was very supportive.
I thought it was a wonderful idea. I really did. Both of us were huge believers in trying to fulfill dreams. A lot of the time, marriage stops you from fulfilling your own individual dreams because you feel you have to get permission from the other person. And I felt that through my 20s, I had fulfilled a lot of my dreams. I'd had a lot of fun. And he went into the army when he was 18, and I felt that it was his turn, really.
So for his third trip, he wanted to walk across Antarctica to fulfill the goal that his hero Shackleton was not able to achieve, but he wanted to do it alone.
Well, I'd say the best thing is the day is mine. Success or failure of this journey is completely up to me. At the moment, I'm up at 7:30, on the trail at 9 a.m.
Each day was similar. I mean, Henry would get up at early in the morning, pack up his sled. This usually took about an hour. His harness would be connected to the sled, and he would begin to haul it, not unlike a mule.
Well, I've been skiing for 90 minutes and then taking a five-minute break, and then off again.
And he would walk with his skis, burning as much as 8,000 calories in a day.
I've been craving food. Fish pie, brown bread, double cream, steak and chips, more chips, smoked salmon, baked potato, eggs, rice pudding, dairy milk, chocolate, tomatoes, bananas, apples.
He would do this Herculean task and challenge day after day. There was something almost primal about it.
And pizza. Just can't wait.
His singular purpose became to just make his mileage. He had to achieve so many miles a day if he was to ultimately accomplish his goal.
9.4 nautical miles today. A lot of it was uphill. Evening, everybody. So, in sum, a tough day. The 9.7 nautical miles were hard won. I travelled a bit longer today, just over 11 nautical miles at this early stage. Everybody, day 21. 10.3 nautical miles was a disappointment, but it's simply 14 nautical miles is all I can do at the moment in a 12-hour day.
He would trek for 14, 15, sometimes 16 hours across an alien landscape that's covered with a sheet of ice, it's pocked with crevasses.
A whiteout with just enough visibility to see the horizon greeted me this morning. It was a very tough day, with many pauses for an intake of breath, leaning forward on my ski sticks, head dropped, summoning everything. At 7 p.m., I checked my mileage covered during the day, and it was 11 decimal 7. At 8 p.m., I checked again, it was 12 decimal 9. Not enough. So I continued until the GPS displayed 13 nautical miles. Today was a test. Perhaps tomorrow will be another. Good night.
And at the end of the day, when he was burrowed in his sleeping bag, he would record a dispatch, an audio diary, updating his growing number of listeners, including many students. Henry always called these students young explorers.
Right, a few young explorer questions, good questions tonight. Archie Stuart Wilson wanted to know if I had the opportunity to ask Shackleton one question, what would it be? I think my question would be, what had he learned about leadership? What kept drawing him to the Antarctic? Did he regret being away from his wife, Emily, and three children for so long?
I talked to him a lot while he was out there on a satellite phone. He found it much harder than other expeditions. That breaking ice is very hard work. And at least if you're with other people, you can take turns to be at the front. Whereas if you're the lead skier for 1,000 miles, it's a great deal harder. He found it cripplingly hard.
Well, good evening, everybody. Location 90 degrees south.
When he got to the South Pole, there's a research station there. But if he was to fulfill his ambition of doing this trip alone and unsupported, he couldn't drop off supplies, he couldn't get a hot mail. And the only thing he really allowed himself was he thought he'd give himself at least a day of rest in his tent.
Well, not much to report today, because I've spent most of it asleep. And I detected my body heading for hibernation. I thought it best to get back into the routine and head off.
He felt the constant strain of making his mileage so that he could reach the end point of the expedition before the end of the month of January, because in February begins the winter season in Antarctica, where the temperature drops even further. It can reach minus 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Even ALE shuts down then. And at that point, there would be no exit.
I left at about 8 p.m. this evening. Only covered 5 miles.
And he hoped that the northern journey, this last phase of his expedition, would be a little bit easier, at least he hoped, than the first phase, that after he reached something called the Titan Dome, which is this massive ice formation, 10,000 feet high, he would at least begin to descend and have the help of gravity pushing him to the finish.
If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew, serve your turn long after they are gone, and so hold on, then there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. Many of you will, of course, recognize those lines by Rudyard Kipling. I'm getting more feeble and more empty, but I still seem to have the will which says to my heart and nerves and sinews, hold on.
I listened to his blogs every day and they were pretty good. They were pretty upbeat. But I was just very concerned. It was 1,000 miles on his own. He was older. He was 55 when he set out instead of 40.
She could hear him growing more tired, and she wondered what she should do.
He worried constantly, that he was being delayed. I was in a terrible position as to whether to say, Henry, stop, just listen for a minute. You are not going to make the end. You cannot make the end. Or say, you'll do it, darling. It's a really difficult one. I chose to say, I'm sure you'll be fine.
Well, I had a very interrupted night's sleep last night. Bad stomach. Probably the weakest I've felt in the entire expedition.
By now, his entire body was in agony. His back throbbed. All his muscles ached. His feet were bruised, his toes were discolored. He was suffering from the early signs of frostbite, especially in his thumb, which he struggled to move. He had lost more than 40 pounds. He was so tired that one day during a snack break, he fell asleep while sitting on his sled in the middle of a whiteout.
I decided to stop and rest up. That's risky, when I need the miles, but you have to listen to your body sometimes. I've slept all day and feel much better. So the plan now is to move off tonight, walk through until tomorrow, and bag 18 miles or so. Time to get back on the trail.
He kept a diary, a personal diary. This one he didn't broadcast. One evening he wrote, legs are stick thin and arms puny.
Andy, and Andrew, it's Henry. Just to let you know, I'm giving in some extra hours at the moment, so my briefs will come, but they may be much shorter. It's now 9 o'clock and I'm giving up another couple of hours.
It was just really not right. There was something really not right about it then. His voice, his despair. He cried quite a lot. He never cried.
He kept thinking he would reach the top of the Titan Dome and begin to descend. He just couldn't seem to reach the top. And so each day he would push longer and longer.
Okay, details day 66, 17 Jan, time travel 16 hours. Well, good evening, everybody. It's a very late broadcast. It's now 1 o'clock in the morning. In order to keep track, I must now do 16 nautical miles per day. This makes for a very long 16-hour day. So that's what I have to do. To do it, I will. As of today, this evening, I got 142 nautical miles to the finish line.
The next day, day 67, his journal entry is short and his writing is increasingly difficult to read. He wrote, mixed bag, white out, soft snow, painful while afraid of stomach, worried about time and distance. On day 68, he didn't record a message for his listeners.
It's all become quite an ordeal at the moment, so I'm not doing any young explorers. No narrative. Could you just explain that time has been caught up? Thanks, Andy.
The next day, on day 69, he scribbled in his diary, awful. Had to stop after 5 hours, totally exhausted, feeling terrible, very deplorable. Rest of day and into following morning, just want it all to end in a good way.
He was unable to move, really, at that stage. And he had lost control of his bowels and his bladder. We had been on the phone nonstop for 2 days. Me, very hysterical, begging him to pull out, and him just asking me to be patient.
Henry, throughout his life, especially whenever he was in danger, and he was in more danger now than he'd ever been in his life, he would always ask himself, what would Shax do? What would Shackleton do? And he had always thought, by endurance we conquer, was the message of Shackleton, that you can always prevail through force of mind. But the thing that set Shackleton apart from so many other explorers who went to their polar grave is that he acknowledged his human limitations and the limitations of his men, and he turned back. That was the thing about Shackleton. Henry was 900 miles into his 1,000-mile journey when he rang ALE and called for the most expensive taxi ride in the world. Then he composed a final public message.
Greetings, everybody. It's Friday the 22nd of January, day 70. When my hero, Ernest Shackleton, rode 97 miles from the South Pole, he said he'd shot his bolt. Well, today, I have to inform you with some sadness that I, too, have shot my bolt. My journey is at an end. I have run out of time, physical endurance, and the simple sheer inability to slide one ski in front of the other. But I've spent 70 days all alone in a place I love. I'll lick my wounds I will heal over time, and I will come to terms with the disappointment. And General Rosie, signing off. Journey's end. We'll see you later.
Ellie arrived later that day, and Henry walked to the plane on his own volition. He was flown to Western Antarctica, the Ellie base camp, and there he called Joanna.
It was such a relief for me, I can't tell you. He was with doctors, and he said to me, I'm fine, I'm going to stay here for a few days and just build up my strength. I'm having a cup of tea and a biscuit, and I'm going to be fine.
But his condition continued to deteriorate, and he was flown overnight to a hospital in southern Chile where they discovered he had peritonitis, which is an infection in the abdomen lining. When Joanna heard he had been taken to a hospital, she hurried to get on a plane. Shortly after she landed in Chile, she received an update that Henry's liver had failed. And shortly after that, she heard that his kidney had failed. And before she could get to the hospital, she learned that Henry had died. The news of Henry's death was greeted in England with an outpouring of emotion. And he was hailed as an inspiration and as a hero, a polar hero, much like the heroes that he had revered growing up. Hundreds of people went to Henry's funeral, including the top military brass, as well as Prince William. In December 2017, nearly 2 years after Henry died, Joanna, Max, and Alicia set off for the island of South Georgia, which was where Shackleton was buried and which Henry himself had visited many years ago. Joanna wore the same coat that Henry had worn on his last expedition, and they carried with them Henry's ashes.
It was a very special day. It's an extraordinary little bay. It has the most magical little Norwegian church. And we had a wonderful service there, and we all poured whiskey onto Shackleton's grave.
They then began to climb up an icy mountain slope. And where the earth was flat, they knelt down and buried Henry's ashes.
Staff writer David Gran, and we heard from Joanna Worsley. Joanna and Henry Worsley's son Max told her that he wanted one day to follow in his father's footsteps and go on an expedition to the Antarctic.
I knew when Henry died that it would only be a matter of time before Max said he wanted to do one. And when he told me, yes, I can't say my heart didn't sink slightly. But Henry's death has not made me lose that really strong feeling of people must fulfill dreams.
Thanks for joining us this week on the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and next time, we'll take a look at the state of diplomacy with North Korea after the seeming calm of the Olympics. I hope you'll join us. And before we go, I want to say thank you and farewell to the Radio Hour's Michael Rayfield, a consummate sound guy with superhuman ears and a unique sense of humor. I'm going to miss him.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Tarina Endowment Fund.